VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and thanks for joining me today on the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. The Paris Agreement under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change proposes to keep any rise in global temperature this century to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But it also seeks to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. Any time before 1850 is generally considered to be pre-industrial. So we're talking about no more than 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above the global temperatures before 1850. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, recently issued its special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. The report suggests that limiting global temperatures would require rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. The IPCC report also suggests steps to limit global warming to more than 1.5 degrees Celsius would provide clear benefits to people and natural ecosystems as compared to the 2 degrees Celsius limit. Today, we'll talk about the new IPCC report and its possible implications. My guest today is Peter Frumhoff, Director of Science and Policy and Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As a global change ecologist, Peter Frumhoff has published and lectured widely on climate science and policy. Peter, what did you take away from the recent IPCC report? And is it as dire as many media outlets have claimed?
The IPCC's report on 1.5 degrees. Let me first say it came out of the agreement that nations, including the United States, agreed to in Paris, where they set a long-term temperature target that temperatures should rise above pre-industrial levels, no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and perhaps as low as 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. We're currently at about 1 degree above pre-industrial levels. That warming, just so everybody understands, is coming primarily from carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases that are emitted mostly from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, that is to say fossil fuels that power today so much of the global economy. And so the nations in Paris tasked the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, with helping governments understand what are the risks that we face, the impacts that we face at 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees increase, in order to guide decisions about where to aim, and also to lay out guidance on how might we get there. What are the ways in which we can transform our energy economy and more broadly our pathways that are driving emissions in order to bring emissions what really need to be, as the IPCC highlights, to essentially zero, what they call net zero, no more carbon dioxide coming into the atmosphere than coming out of it, by about mid-century. And so that was what the IPCC was tasked to do. And I must say, as a former lead author of the IPCC and as a climate scientist, I have never read a more sobering and stark assessment of the disruptive climate impacts that we are moving towards as temperatures warm and of the, as the IPCC says, the rapid and far-reaching transitions that will be needed if we're to stave off the worst impacts.
Peter, again, media reports, and you just verified a few seconds ago, that the report is pretty gloomy and dire. What specifically in the report paints this bad picture?
Well, so as I think everybody knows, we're already seeing impacts from climate change at just 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels, from Hurricane Michael that's hit the Southeast U.S. to Hurricane Florence that hit other parts of the Southeast U.S. weeks earlier, to tropical cyclones in the Pacific hitting the Philippines and China, to other periods of extreme heat and extreme flooding. We are seeing climate change in the here and now, in the present tense, in ways that are already happening faster and with more impact than had been predicted just or projected just some years ago. And what we're finding is that with every passing year, our understanding of climate risks is growing in a way that it's telling us that the risks of future warming are greater at lower temperatures than we had previously understood. And the IPCC 1.5 report unpacks that. We used to think of a 2-degree increase as kind of a safe guardrail. And now this report, drawing on the most recent peer-reviewed science, is telling us, for example, that at 2 degrees increase, that is a doubling of the warming we're seeing so far, a level that we'll reach in just a few decades at current emissions, that we would basically lead to the complete decline of all coral reefs. That is to say, you know, something like 500,000 people across the planet rely on coral reefs as resources for fishing. It's a great, important source for marine biodiversity, important for forestalling the impacts of rising oceans on vulnerable coastlines in many parts of the world. Coral reef decline would reach virtually 100% under a 2-degree target. And at 1.5 degrees, it would certainly be better, something on the order of 70 to 80% decline in coral reefs. So we're already seeing these highly vulnerable ecosystems impacted greatly, impacts with bleaching, for example, to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. But at a 2-degree increase, they're basically gone. We're seeing extreme heat at 2 degrees being 2.5 times worse, according to the IPCC, than at 1.5 degrees. And, you know, something like 40% of the global population would be exposed to extreme heat every 5 years or so, truly damaging extreme heat with risks of mortality and morbidity in a way that would be far lower at 1.5 degrees. 2 degrees would lead to a far greater sea level rise this century than 1.5 degrees, and potentially entrain a much longer term destabilizing of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets that would lead to several meters of sea level rise over the course of the next several centuries. And of course, most of us are concerned, and understandably so, with what happens, you know, this year, or from a business perspective, this business cycle, or perhaps the lives of our children. But a couple hundred years ago, if people had had these kinds of risks facing them and had failed to make choices, the world would be far different today had they not acted on them. And we have an obligation not only to ourselves and to our kids, but to future generations, to recognize the potentially truly catastrophic risks of sea level rise at temperatures that we're likely to reach this century if we don't dramatically reduce our emissions.
When we're talking about global warming and climate change, are we talking about the same thing, or are there differences between the two terms?
No, that's a great question. They tend to be used interchangeably. The report is on global warming at 1.5 degrees. That's essentially the title of the report. It is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So in a narrow sense, warming refers to literally the temperature rise, and climate change refers to the whole cascading set of changes that result from or are associated with that temperature rise. But they tend to get used interchangeably. So, for example, as the Earth warms, as the atmosphere warms, it holds more moisture. And so global warming leads to, among other things, more extensive periods of greater severity of extreme flooding, as well as periods of extreme drought. Both can happen through a warmer world. And so the changes in climate include changes in precipitation, rainfall patterns, snowfall patterns, as well as temperature rise per se.
Right now, what country is the leader of producing carbon dioxide?
Well, so on a per capita basis, on a per person basis, the United States produces by far the highest level of carbon dioxide emissions. Of course, other nations, such as China, have far larger populations. And from a total emissions perspective, China is now slightly larger than the United States in terms of total carbon dioxide emissions. But all nations need to take action to reduce emissions. That was what was really the centerpiece of the Paris Agreement. That is to say, the 185 some odd nations that signed up to the Paris Agreement, including the United States, made what were called contributions, nationally determined contributions, to reduce emissions, each looking at its own capacity and ability and wherewithal to make change. And so, for example, the United States made a commitment through its NDC, its nationally determined contribution, to reduce our nation's emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025, just 7 years from now. And we are partway on the path to get there, but it's only through much greater ambition that we can actually fulfill that. And indeed, if we're going to collectively bring temperatures below 2 degrees, let alone to 1.5 degrees, we have to accelerate that ambition. The total package of commitments that nations made, the US, China, India, European nations, all developing countries that made their commitments together, if nations live into those commitments, we would see a temperature rise of roughly 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That is to say, those initial contributions, those commitments, were important but relatively modest down payments on the level of ambition that will be needed if even the very dark higher level of warming identified in this report is to be avoided.
I want to read to you a statement that I felt was very interesting from one of President Trump's deputy press secretaries, Lindsay Walters. Lindsay Walters recently issued a statement that said, from 2005 to 2017, U.S. CO2-related emissions declined by 14%, while global energy-related CO2 emissions rose by 21% during the same time. What are your thoughts on that statement?
Thank you for raising that. There's nothing inherently untrue about it. It is true that our emissions in the United States have declined over that 10 or 12-year time period, mostly because over that period, a very large number of coal plants in the United States were shut down. Not because of any policy, but because they were no longer economically attractive. That is to say, renewable energy in particular, wind and solar, as well as to some extent natural gas, have become much cheaper in recent decades. And basic market economics have led to an acceleration of the reliance on renewable energy in the United States and the decline of coal plants. So looking at this as a kind of historical fact, one can look at that and understand that that's how that transition has made. That person's statement looks backwards but doesn't look forward, right? If the U.S. is to get to the modest, relative to where we need to get, ambitions of our nationally determined contributions, that 26-28% by 2025, every coherent analysis, every detailed analysis that has been put forward recognizes that policies, in addition to economics, will be needed. Policies such as fuel economy standards that increase the efficiency of our vehicle fleet, policies that may put a price on carbon and reduce the economic attractiveness of natural gas relative to clean energy such as renewables and also potentially nuclear. And the IPCC report highlights this as well, that they anticipate that if we're going to reach these levels of emissions reductions over the course of the next several decades, we would be seeing renewable energy making up something like 75 or 80% of our global electricity production. All of this is a way of saying that what's happened so far is a good down payment, but to move forward, this administration, that is to say the U.S., as well as other nations, need to do far more. And if I may say so, unfortunately, the U.S. administration has not only avoided taking seriously the science of climate change, but has also begun to enact a set of reversals of policies that will lead not to a decline in further emissions, but rather an increase.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. And we'll hope you get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Now back to our program. Today we're talking about the recently issued special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, as well as the implications of the report. My guest today is Peter Fromhoff, Director of Science and Policy and Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty here, Peter. How much time do you think we have as a planet before we reach the so-called point of no return?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rick, and it's a really hard one to be specific about. I mean, let's face it, the impacts of climate change are already here. We're seeing them in more severe hurricanes and other storms. We're seeing them in wildfires that are growing worse with every passing year. We're seeing them in more intense precipitation here in the Northeast U.S. where I live, and in impacts across the globe, often affecting the most vulnerable communities and nations among us who have the least capacity to cope. So climate change is here, it's going to continue, and there will be surprises and thresholds that we will and may cross where the impacts will become truly catastrophic. The reason why the nations in Paris set as an aspirational goal the 1.5 degrees C target was because of evidence that was beginning to accumulate even before the Paris meeting in 2015, that level of ambition, as Herculean as it is, may be necessary to avoid truly existential risks to low-lying nations such as small island states. And they rightly and appropriately advocated for a very aggressive target. What this report tells us is that in many ways, even 1.5 degrees may not be low enough. But the important thing is that every step we take, every tenth of a degree that we can avoid increases in, is an opportunity for us to make the world a better place for generations to come. And so, yes, the warnings here are dire. As I said, they are more sober and more disconcerting than any climate science report I've previously read, because that's where the facts are taking us. And it lays out an unbelievably challenging but important opportunity to transition to clean energy, to find technologies, many of which we really have today. It's not a matter of our understanding of the risks or of technological feasibility. It's about political will to move to a different path. And so this report tells us there's no time to wait. And my hope is that not just governments, but civil society, because civil society informs and motivates governments, will move swiftly to ensure that these warnings get heeded. I would say that one of the things the report tells us is that in addition to the things we know about today to reduce emissions, renewable energy, energy efficiency, eating less beef, which is a major source of emissions, electrifying our transportation sector, the many things that we can do today that are already beginning to happen may need to be complemented by approaches not only to reduce emissions, but to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And the report really brings those to the fore, that we're in a kind of world of hard choices and we need every option on the table. That includes everything from things we know today, like planting trees, regrowing forests, because growing trees through photosynthesis draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But it also means investing in research and development to explore more technological approaches to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, things that are by no means going to be magic solutions. There's a portfolio of options that we need to both enact and invest in. But we can no longer rely only on the one or two things that we love the most. We really need to be working at every opportunity about how we use land, how we use energy, and how we make food choices in order to make the transformation that we need.
I want to run another quote past you. This is from Jim Skia, or Skay. He's the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 3, which I believe put this report together. He says limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is possible within the laws of chemistry and physics, but doing so would require unprecedented changes. What does he mean by unprecedented changes? What would need to be done in order to reach that limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius?
It's a great question, and it's really the unprecedented scale of change that's needed. We have made transformational changes in society before, but the scale of change to bring emissions roughly to half of where they are today by 2030, which is what the IPCC report highlights, roughly halving total emissions by, you know, in just, what, 11 or 12 years. And then in another 20 years, bringing emissions essentially to zero, no more carbon going into the atmosphere than coming out, reducing emissions not just of carbon dioxide, but of other heat-trapping gases such as methane. It requires, again, no single solution, but a very broad sweep of changes across all sectors of society and across all nations to transform our energy economy most first and foremost. And in the context of, let's face it, a great deal of inertia that is part of it's sort of the physical inertia of the way in which power plants have intended lives of decades to come, for example. But most importantly, the political inertia of societies, including in the United States, that it's very hard for change to happen when powerful political influences constrain transformation, when votes get influenced by, to be honest, the fossil fuel industry in my country, as well as in others. So that's where the unprecedented change in political will that needs to underlie the transformation of our energy economy really is our greatest challenge, is can we overcome societies, the political and societal inertia associated with business as usual, the business as usual that keeps political leaders in office who are opposing climate change or who deny science and who are not willing to invest in solutions that look beyond the next election but look to future generations. That's my greatest worry. But if I may just add one thing, it's probably important, I would say, for your listeners to recognize that there isn't just one voice of America. There are many voices of America. And at this moment in time, if I may say so, the national or federal government's voice of America on climate is heading us in the wrong direction, is not affirming the science or even accepting the science of the IPCC and the implications for how we power our economy. Quite the opposite. But there are other voices in this country. There are states. The state of California, for example, has just set a goal of having net zero emissions by 2045. The state of New Jersey, of Massachusetts, other states around the country are similarly laying out ambitions for reducing emissions. There are voices of business, many business leaders in this country responding to their consumers, their customers, are beginning to source their energy from Google to Facebook to others from 100% clean or renewable energy, for example. There are voices of municipalities, of cities, who are looking for ways to electrify vehicles. They're looking for ways to, in some cases through lawsuits, to hold the fossil fuel companies accountable for the climate damages that they're beginning to witness, to pay their fair share of the costs of climate change. They are, and those include cities across this country as well as in other nations as well. And there are voices of civil society that are rising up in this country who are calling for action. And, you know, there are elections. So I don't want this interview to become a political conversation, but it is important because choices need to be made if we're going to stave off a truly climate catastrophe that the science of the IPCC puts front and square in front of us that are going to require changes in the political inertia. I just want your listeners to understand that many of those changes are coming at subnational levels in this country because we are not monolithic.
I want to get into something that you had mentioned earlier, and that's the release of methane. I've been reading reports about the permafrost in the Arctic. Can you describe what the permafrost is?
Yeah, so thank you for raising that. In the Arctic, in the tundra in particular, there are deep stores of carbon in forms of both carbon dioxide and methane that remain frozen. If the Earth warms enough, and of course we're seeing faster rates of warming at the poles than we are in the mid-latitudes. So as temperatures begin to rise there, the permafrost, this deep layer of carbon-rich material, is beginning to thaw. As it thaws, methane, as well as carbon dioxide, can become released. Sometimes those releases get accelerated not just by warming, but by fires, including fires on the tundra, that are beginning to happen in places where they really haven't happened before, not at the pace that we're seeing, which also increased warming of the soils and the permafrost beneath them. This is a very serious issue. There's tremendous potential for a feedback loop that would accelerate warming should that permafrost become released. And what the IPCC report highlights, for example, is one difference, one projected difference between the amount of Arctic permafrost that will thaw, therefore releasing carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere, is between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. 2 degrees would increase the amount that's thawed by about 2 million square kilometers. That's a very large area, and about 40% worse than at 1.5 degrees. And that may be also accelerated by the decline in sea ice in the Arctic, which transitions reflective ice to a dark water surface that absorbs more solar energy, warms more quickly, and warms the region, including areas of the tundra, more quickly. So there are these positive feedback loops, but there's nothing positive about it in a societal sense. They're self-reinforcing in the sense that further warming can greatly accelerate the release of methane and carbon dioxide from the permafrost, thus further accelerating warming. And that is really deeply worrisome. So anything we can do to keep temperatures from rising to the point where the further releases get triggered is in our global interest.
Before we wrap things up, I'd like to talk about, again, the effects and impacts of climate change on humanity. And first of all, what parts of the world have the greatest impact from climate change? Where is it being felt the most?
Well, it's being felt all over the world, to be honest, Rick. It's really about where in the world do we have our greatest challenges with coping. a storm of the magnitude that we've seen with the hurricanes, for example, that have recently come to the southeast U.S. are devastating. But when they come, for example, to other parts of, in this case, the United States, like Puerto Rico, such as the major hurricane that hit there last year, a community that is poorer than other parts of the U.S., the impacts are far more devastating because the capacity to cope, the capacity to be resilient is inherently less. And that cascades across much of the developing world. So sea level rise will have really dramatic impacts on low-lying nations, whether they be small island states or Bangladesh, because those nations have such limited capacity to cope with impacts that we should be clear are coming primarily from the history of the cumulative emissions, primarily from industrialized countries. So they're feeling the brunt, but have not been the major cause by far of the sources of emissions. So the poor, the vulnerable, the least developed in both the U.S. in that context, including Puerto Rico, as well as other countries, will be far the hardest hit, and they have the least resources to cope. And so one of the elements of the Paris Agreement was to establish financial mechanisms to begin to allow for industrialized countries, the wealthier countries, to support consideration of coping for developing countries. But those funds have not been well populated yet. And it's my hope, and really, I think, our moral obligation as wealthier nations to support coping with the impacts that emissions from our growing industries and our way of life have primarily driven.
Peter, some of the programs on television that I've seen about climate change paint a horrific picture because of the impact of climate change on sea level rise. Do you see us getting to a point where we have such extreme rise in sea level?
Well, so the projections for sea level rise are on the order of up to a meter, perhaps more, by the end of this century. So will the whole east coast of the United States be underwater? No. Will large areas of, for example, low-lying areas such as in Florida and the Gulf Coast that are already beginning to be inundated on a regular basis become essentially uninhabitable? Yes. We at the Union of Concerned Scientists have released several reports, for example, that actually quantify the amount of property that's at risk along the coastal regions of the continental U.S. And there are tremendous growth of real estate. People want to live on the coasts. And a lot of that real estate will be essentially uninhabitable over the course of this century at the sea level rises that we are anticipating. And that will have major transformational impacts for our coastlines. Again, also, it depends on the timescale that you're asking about. So a meter of sea level rise is horrific and will have major impacts across the developing world as well as this country. What is even more challenging to contemplate is the risk that even at these ambitious temperature reductions that we're needing to make, the much larger levels of sea level rise that are currently locked in the ice that sits above Greenland and West Antarctica would become destabilized and over the course of several hundred years increase sea levels many meters. And yes, consistent with what we've seen over the course of geologic history, potentially dramatically transform coasts, not just across the United States, but across the planet. These are the worlds that we're living into, but these are also the worlds that we can avoid. And I think despite the dire nature, or perhaps because of the dire warnings poured, I think it's incumbent on us as living, breathing, morally obligated, conscious human beings to take every action we can to maintain a sustainable planet, not just for ourselves and our kids, but for future generations. And that's the kind of transformational change that this report highlights is needed, and it will require tremendous political will, there's no doubt.
Peter Fromhoff, I want to thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to talk to us about this very important issue, and also for your wonderful insights. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Rick.
That was Peter Fromhoff, Director of Science and Policy and Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I am afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank our studio technicians, Tian Wang and Cornelius Tenner. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.